We came by her and there was a little towel put out, and then there were like 10 little half-broken ornaments on there that they were spraying with something to decontaminate them. And that's what they were finding in her to remember her whole house by, you know.
Because it was 3 months later, the entire site was covered in sunflowers that had seeded from bird feeders, or we don't know where they came from, but they were growing in almost every property possible. So there was this strange, beautiful thing happening amongst these ruins.
Welcome back to Archival Ecologies, a story series about the intersections between archives and cultural collections and the environments where they reside. This season, we're traveling to the historic town and reserves of Lytton, a small town in the Fraser Canyon region of British Columbia that burned down in a 2021 wildfire. Archival Ecologies is led and hosted by me, Jamie Collins, and is a production of Blue Lab at Princeton University.
Lorna's museum, along with the village office, nothing stood a chance.
The collection was second only to the Royal BC Museum, and it was one of the most important ones in North America.
In this episode, we'll follow just one of the many stories of salvage and recovery that have defined the area's archival ecologies since the fire. The story of the Lytton Chinese History Museum and its founding director, Lorna Fandridge.
Lorna Fandridge is trying to rebuild the Lytton Chinese History Museum, and like many other businesses, is hitting one roadblock after roadblock.
The process has been heartbreaking, but also rewarding for Lorna, who's determined to rebuild.
We start this episode's story in a small patch of grass next to a parking lot near the Stein Valley Inklakama School, the community-based independent school on the Lytton First Nation Reserve, just 5 minutes north of the Lytton Town Center. A music festival called Two Rivers Remix is underway in a field behind the school on a plateau elevated above the river. The grass has been mowed. It's green still, but dry and spiky to the touch from the threat of the desert's heat, even now in early summer. It's late June, and the Fraser Canyon typically won't reach its hottest for a few more weeks. And yet, music festival volunteers circulate with spray wands, dousing the grass in water to prevent the outbreak of fire. There are electrical wires crisscrossing the field to power the musical equipment. There isn't anything remarkable about this particular patch of grass, and yet, with each step, grasshoppers erupt from the ground around me, otherwise invisible in the small shade available between the blades of grass. With each step, a new wave crests away from me. The small patch of earth is brimming with grasshoppers. Grasshoppers have always lived in this ecosystem, although they haven't always been welcome. Embedded in the grasshoppers is a story about contamination and about the residues of history that, though unseen, live in the soil and continue to shape how humans, animals, and insects make life here. In the 19th century, across the arid, grassy regions of the interior of British Columbia that includes Lytton, settlers established ranches, grazing cattle across the bunchgrass plateaus that border the region's rivers. During this time, grasshopper eruptions rarely posed a problem. By the late 19th century, however, overgrazing and other land management practices that attended colonization gave rise to grasshopper swarms that damaged grasslands and negatively impacted cattle grazing. As cattle herds grew, grass everywhere became smaller, younger, and more tender, providing good food for the grasshoppers who preferred the fresh sprouts. A feedback loop. Unregulated grazing transformed the grassland habitat into prime grasshopper habitat, which in turn threatened the cattle industry. Focused on ranchers' livelihoods, the provincial government chose not to regulate grazing activity and instead launched a pesticide campaign that applied chemical agents, arsenic in particular, to large swaths of land in an attempt to control the grasshopper population. While the results are sparsely recorded in the historical record, there is evidence that the poison did not only kill grasshoppers. Chickens and some cattle were also killed, while the wider ecological effects on wildlife and on waterways remain unknown. In this period, the government also lobbied First Nations residents to treat their land with the same chemicals, perhaps in a place like the patch of grass I stood in last summer. In one recorded instance from the 19th century, the poison killed cattle, chickens, and made several children ill on one reserve. That community then refused to place any more on their land, but that isn't to say the arsenic wasn't all around them, didn't leach into the water, foods, wildlife, and soils. The soil stores the residues of these chemicals, just as it stores other fragments of history. Surviving in this landscape is to survive contamination and to navigate the histories embedded in the soil. The story of surviving the fire is no different. After the fire, the soil beneath the village of Lytton was contaminated by incinerated building materials. At the same time, it became an archaeological site. Patches of earth that buildings had covered for 100 years were revealed, making it possible to excavate for artifacts, especially from the First Nations village that was there before it was Lytton.
The mayor sits down here and he does something different. He talks to the province, says, look, I'm a little concerned because many of these buildings here were built in the early 1900s, 1920s, the ones that weren't lost to various fires. So can we test the soil? The soil tests come back. It's 584 pages long. There's immediate risk to health and safety in the water, in the air, and in the soil.
This is Patrick Michel, retired chief of the Kanakabar Indian Band and lifelong Lytton resident who lost his house in the fire. In the summer of 2023, 2 years after the fire, the town center is still a mess of dry dirt, weeds, concrete, plastic, rebar, styrofoam, and other building material pockmarked by huge holes. Evidence of the effort to ascertain and remove contaminants that the fire released into the soil. This landscape is a visceral reminder of the slow pace of recovery.
What would be the right word? Discouraging. Yeah, they had to take off dirt. And then when they took the dirt off, they decided that, oh yes, but it's a historical site, so we have to do archaeological.
Richard Forrest is showing us around the site of the Lytton Museum and Archives, which he founded and continues to steward. As Richard describes, central to the recovery process has been decontamination, which has involved arduous processes of repeatedly testing and removing soil. In British Columbia, given provincial regulations about digging in sensitive cultural areas where there may be First Nations archaeological material, this work has needed to be done in collaboration with archaeologists. The ground here is more than biological matter. It's also a historical archive of life, from pre-colonial settlement patterns through to the industrial and chemical infrastructures of contemporary life.
The problem is the archaeologists couldn't come in until the contamination was done, but the contamination couldn't come in until the archaeologists cleared the land. 3 yards from us, they found human remains.
So between the two of them, it's been 2 years.
In the immediate aftermath of the fire, concerns about contamination forestalled any opportunities for the recovery of cultural and community collections in the burn zone.
We couldn't gain access to the site for a full 3 months afterwards.
This is Casey Lee, an object conservator and one of the founding members of the British Columbia Heritage Emergency Response Network. This province-wide organization trains conservators and community members in the protection and recovery of heritage materials during emergency situations and organizes response teams. Casey was on the ground in Lytton during a salvage operation for cultural material that survived the fire.
It was declared a contaminated site. They had the products of combustion and Lord knows what else, asbestos and mold. It was evident by October that there were some cultural sites that could possibly be salvaged, and the sooner the better. Winter was coming and things were exposed.
For 3 months after the late June fire, artifacts and other significant materials sat out in the weather, exposed to the elements, including a cumulative 14 centimeters of rainfall, to contaminants, to nesting and burrowing animals, and to other curious interlopers. To survive both the fire and this period of exposure, any one object needed to be very durable. Metals and ceramics, say, instead of paper or plant material, and was probably buried in protective layers of ash. But by fall, time was of the essence. Winter was coming fast and the site was still under quarantine. Not even residents had been allowed back to see what remained of their homes. Then, 1 month after the team of conservators finally gained access to the site, atmospheric rivers drenched the province, causing mudslides in the burned areas that devastated the highway system in the province. 2 years later, that too was still being rebuilt. Across 3 weekend-long visits, the conservators worked across all the heritage sites in Lytton, but they were particularly successful in salvaging material at the Lytton Chinese History Museum, in part because of the nature of the collection. Ceramics are designed to survive fire.
I just knew that if it wasn't pottery, I'm not going to find it. You know, I just knew it was past that already. I've had many people ask me why I'm still rebuilding. There may not be a community. There may not be tourists. Two reasons. I still want to tell the Chinese story. And because I don't want to be one of the businesses that bails on the town either. So whatever small contribution I can make, I would like to go ahead.
Opened in 2017 on the site of a former Joss House or Chinese temple building in central Lytton, the Lytton Chinese History Museum aims to carry forward the histories and experiences of Chinese settlers and migrant workers in the area.
And so 2015, it became a BC Chinese historical site, and then it's also on the Canadian Registry. And with that, then I thought, okay, I have credibility with the Chinese community now. And so then I just went ahead and decided to build it in 2016, and we opened in 2017. And then, of course, as you know, it lasted from 2017 till 21 when the fire occurred, and we lost everything. There were 1,600 pieces there.
In one sense, the museum has always been a project of recovery. Recovery of a site whose significance to the town as a Joss House had been forgotten. Recovery of an undertold history of objects and the people and lives for whom they were meaningful.
So for the original museum in 2016, I only had 200 artifacts, some from here, some from actually Kumsheen because there was a railway camp here in 1883. And so I had very little. And then as I started putting up the building, a man, Al Dreyer from Lillooet, came and asked me if I would like to buy his collection. That was just over 800 pieces. And he had collected them over the years from Lillooet, Lytton, and Ashcroft.
Much of Lorna's collection came from local sites, gathered by residents from the landscape, objects sometimes on old trash sites or just next to the river where people would walk. Objects lay out in the weather for decades, becoming embedded in the landscape to persist as history.
He would go to the common sites. For example, in Lytton, a lot of the pieces that he collected were just over the bank from what is the reserve end of the town. And that's because at that time, everybody just threw all of their garbage over the bank towards the river. So that was the beginning. So upstairs, we just sort of began with talking about people coming for the gold rush. Artifacts there were partly from here, things like mule shoes or gold pan or things that we found on this site, actually. And then about 12 miles up the Fraser, there was a Chinese mining camp there. It's on indigenous land. And so Bill Paul lives on that land. And so he brought me a lot of pieces, more to do with mining or household things, you know, that had been out beside the river for years and very rusted.
Lorna also gathered objects from Chinese settlers who had since moved away from the Lytton area and who chose to donate their objects to the museum to tell the history of their family in this place.
And the ones I feel the most sad about are the things I got from the Chong family that were here. So I got pieces of their mom's diary, I think it was their wedding skirt, and lots of documents about they leased land from other people here to grow vegetables in the 1920s. And so those are the things. I'm really sorry I lost. I have photos of them, luckily, but I did lose those for the Chong family. That was tough, yeah.
In the wake of the wildfire, Lorna has been determined to recover these histories for a second time by rebuilding the museum.
It's a difficult decision when you're just told, okay, you're leaving now, and what do you take? You know, we have the bags packed for the insurance, your personal items, but deciding what to take. So if I'd gone in the museum, I know I wouldn't have thought of a thing, but it was too late anyway. It was way too late.
Just gone, you know. Oh, I mean, what can you say? It's gone.
Intermixed with Lorna's commitment to rebuilding is this profound sense of loss. While much of the museum collection has a digital record, many of the pieces are irreplaceable. Rebuilding, therefore, raises a number of questions. How do you create a local history museum with only a few surviving objects, themselves significantly altered by the fire? What stories do these remaining objects tell? Can newly acquired objects, some of which may come from different areas, convey the same local histories? For Lorna, the power of objects inheres in the stories people attach to them and then the intergenerational memories and family histories that stir in people when they encounter a familiar item.
Once two ladies came, they were from Edmonton. There's a 60-year-old, and she had brought along her aunt and an aunt's friend, and they were like 90. And they came in, and they went into the room where I have all the medicine bottles, and they started talking really excitedly. And they just started laughing and talking to me, saying, oh yeah, this medicine here, I mean, they're 90, right? My mom used to force us to take this all the time, and it tastes terrible. They couldn't believe there would still be a bottle around of this terrible stuff, you know? So those are the things that were fun for me, when people came in, and it just brought back this memory of their early time, which is, yeah, pretty good. I tried to convince one of those ladies to just stay, tell stories all summer, but it didn't work.
The history of Chinese settlers in British Columbia is shaped by absence of documentation, of artifacts, and of firsthand accounts. According to the predominant narratives, that history begins when the gold rush reaches the province in spring 1858, at which point British Columbia is colloquially known as Gold Mountain. March 22, 1858, Puget Sound Herald.
Late and important from Victoria, Vancouver Island. Gold discovery confirmed. Rich gold fields found on Fraser's and Thompson's rivers. By the arrival at this port yesterday of the schooner Wild Pigeon, Captain Jones, we've been put in possession of late and highly interesting intelligence from the gold fields of the Shuswap country. Captain Jones reports that the excitement relative to the gold fields lately discovered on Fraser's and Thompson's rivers is very great.
Piles of rubble from this period that stand taller than a person can still be seen along the rivers in the region, and even in the middle of towns like nearby Lillooet. They are reminders of how foundational gold rush history is to life here. And mining continues to shape the region's ecology. To this day, people can still stake claims for so-called placer mines, which involve digging up gravel adjacent to streams, either by hand or with excavation equipment, to find the gold flakes within it. It is remarkably easy and cheap to stake these claims. There's an online registration and a nominal fee of a couple of $100s. And these claims can be made within private property and on First Nations reserve land. These informal mining operations never undergo environmental assessment, despite there being evidence that they have a negative effect on salmon stock and on the broader river ecology. Can you find anything?
Tiny piece.
The Fraser Canyon gold rush would last less than 10 years, petering out by the mid-1860s, but it utterly transformed life in the area. The Fraser Canyon War broke out in June 1858 between predominantly white miners staking claims to land and Inklakatma people defending their territory. The economic boom of the mining industry made the land very valuable to both British and American interests, leading to Britain claiming British Columbia as a colony in August 1858, mere months after the discovery of gold. It became a colony that would go on to join Canadian Confederation in 1871. It was British Columbia joining Confederation that led to the construction of the Canadian Pacific Railroad. During this time, many Chinese immigrants arrived in search of a fortune in gold or in search of steady, if dangerous, work on the railroad. After the railroad's completion in 1885, Chinese workers were left stranded. A series of laws passed by the government between 1875 and 1923, including the notorious Chinese Exclusion Act, disenfranchised Chinese immigrants and their descendants, depriving them of the right to vote, and limited further immigration to the province. The lack of readily available employment in white society led to vibrant communities of small businesses in Chinese enclaves and Chinatowns. There is one surviving firsthand account of Chinese life in central British Columbia from this period in the diary of Duke Sang Wong, a man who emigrated from China in search of prosperity and worked in harsh conditions on the Canadian Pacific Railway in the late 1800s. After the railway's completion, Wong would go on to become a tailor, raising 8 children in the province with his wife. For many years, Wong's diary wasn't known to historians, nor was it collected in a museum. It survived in the family after his death and was translated into English in the 1960s by his granddaughter Wanda Joy Ho as a school project. The original diary burned in a fire just a few years later, but the translation survived, tucked away in a desk for years, until a writer named David McIlraith learned of its existence when he encountered a fragment in a small museum in the Fraser Canyon. He reached out to the granddaughter and facilitated publication. While only pieces of Duca Sangwong's diary survived the years, it is an invaluable firsthand account of the harsh labor conditions and day-to-day lives of Chinese railroad workers in British Columbia. It is a crucial document of illness, starvation, dangerous work, and racism. Today, the English translation can be found in bookstores and libraries all over North America.
My soul cries out, I wish I had never experienced such bad days as those in which we now live. Many of our people have been so very ill for such a long time, and there has been no medicine nor good food to give them. The white doctor has told us the illnesses come from a lack of fresh food, but we cannot grow any fresh food, as all of us, including the white people, are moving constantly with the work we have to do.
Many such firsthand histories, like Wong's diary, live tossed over an embankment in a junk pile or tucked away in a drawer. Nor do all such histories need to be public. But Lorna's museum was a place that brought disparate documents and objects together, a project of salvage and recovery that held space for the personal histories that have shaped life in this landscape.
To me, having the physical objects there instead of a photo, for example, has more value in my mind. But at the same time, if you didn't have those, at least have a digital collection, you can still tell the story. That's what we're about, right? We're not about having, 25 pots or 10 old cars. We're about what happened with the old car.
Lorna's approach to recovery from the fire is shaped by a similar spirit of salvage and recovery.
This is where the cement walls were still here, right? So
standing at the site of her museum, Lorna remembers what she saw her first time back, 3 months after the fire.
So everything had fallen down and had burned. And so there was about 14 inches of ash with just a bit of metal, which was like the stove, the fridge, ducting, and a few of the display cases were still showing. But right here is where some of them were melted to the cement with the melted glass, and they were standing up in the air like this because the glass had hardened before they actually fell.
In the immediate aftermath of the fire, local stewards reached out to BC Heritage Emergency Response Network. I talked to two conservators, Casey and Heidi, who were on the ground during the salvage mission in Lytton.
I'm Heidi Swaringa, and we're here at the Museum of Anthropology at UBC, where I am the senior conservator and head of the Collections Care Management and Access Program. I'm on the steering group of the BC HERN, the British Columbia Heritage Emergency Response Network. A few local conservators kind of stepped back and said, well, surely there must be some organized response to a heritage after an emergency. And so we started looking across Canada to see if there were any other processes out there. And we quickly found that no, there was nothing out there that already existed within the country for emergency response of collections after an emergency or a disaster. Heritage seemed to be this missing piece of the puzzle, both for response and recovery. We were contacted at the outset by John Hogan and Laura Fenditch just by email saying, this has happened. We don't know what's going on. Hoping you can help in the future.
It would be 3 months before anything happened.
We were contacted by Team Rubicon Canada, who turned out was one of the first NGOs who was given the permitting to gain access to the site, which community members and family members still hadn't been able to get back.
Well, I don't know that much about Rubicon, but they enabled us to gain access to the site and provided us with the advanced training in personal protective equipment that we needed, got insurance in place, made us these what they call spontaneous volunteers.
We were at the Lytton Museum and Archives, and then we were working with John Hogan on a couple locations within the community, and most significantly it was the Elgin, the historical church. And that first trip, we were driven through the site to get to Lorna's museum, and the only way to describe it was gutting. The bottom of your stomach dropped out. It was shocking how different it was from site to site and how different the recovery outcomes were, or the salvage outcomes, I should say.
Conservators like Heidi and Casey are experts at dealing with contamination. I'm meeting Heidi in Vancouver at the Museum of Anthropology, which is closed for seismic upgrades. Because of the loud construction noise, we're meeting in the museum's cavernous basement in the textile storage room. To enter the room, I walk across a sticky mat designed to remove bugs, dirt, or bacteria from my shoes and protect the delicate collections from outside contaminants. But the objects in such collections can themselves also sometimes be contaminated from historic conservation practices like dousing objects in toxic chemicals or from the heavy metals used in old bookbinding practices.
Anyone who had access at that point had to be with an escort. We had masks on our faces from the time that we turned off the highway.
Even for conservators trained to work with contamination, the learning curve to work in the Lytton Burn site was steep.
This was over the top of anything that we had done before. And because of the level of contamination, the hazard involved, there were very specific protocols. They had to train us in the use of these really heavy-duty yellow rubberized suits, had the masks and the goggles and the hoods and several layers of gloves, and everything was taped up so there was no chance for any nasties getting to our bodies. It requires two or sometimes three people to get each person into this equipment and then out of it again.
Conservators spent a day and a half at Lorna's site, descending in the ash-filled outline of the museum and its basement, sifting carefully through the site for any objects that survived the fire.
There was a lot of rubble, a lot of cement and stone and ash, as well as the remains of metal display cases and melted glass.
It was initially a very slow process to find a way through the remains of the building safely and without risking further damage.
When we got there, it was 3 months later, so all of that sediment had been rained on and settled and compacted.
There was this incredibly irregular surface with holes underneath. You didn't know where your foot was going to go through or where you were going to trip on something that you couldn't see because it was just out of your line of sight. So a lot of the first day was just spent clearing a pathway and making it safe to be down there. It wasn't really until the second day that we started finding things.
Conservators worked closely with local stewards in the recovery process. Both Casey and Heidi reflected on how integral Lorna was to the salvage operation at the Lytton Chinese History Museum.
It was so important that Lorna was there with us. She was our consultant. She was really the ringmaster for the whole operation.
Lorna, for example, drew us a map when we got there to say, all right, here's the staff room. Don't worry about that area. Here's the collection storage area. When you get down there, this corner is more important than that other corner. And then also critically, as we were able to recover items from the site and bring them up to the surface, Lorna was the one who would be reviewing everything and making decisions on the spot about what would be cleaned and retained versus what would be considered not keepable.
As conservators brought objects out of the site, they were carefully washed, sorted, and packed away.
We had to remove these from the heavily contaminated basement, and they were brought up to the people on ground level where we'd set up a succession of wash basins. So decontamination was our main goal there. We weren't doing conservation treatments like we would normally do in a lab. We weren't mending things and we weren't even really cleaning them. We were rinsing them off. We were helping Lorna to identify things that were encrusted with dirt and ash. So that helped her decision-making process. And we were also creating a discard pile. So a lot of what we brought up, it was in such bad shape that Lorna said, no, I can't use that. You know, it's really not exhibitable.
And that's an oxen shoe, half of an oxen shoe. I think they're hard to come by, and I don't think I'll find another one. It's part of the, you know, wagon road gold rush story to have those. So I'll keep that one even though it's very damaged.
Although many of the items that the team recovered were damaged beyond use, Lorna was able to salvage around 200 pieces in various states, including several so-called railway teapots.
Those teapots were important to me. They're called railway teapots, and it's because at the top they have this little design, two parallel lines with lines like this. I don't think it has anything to do with the railway, but people call them that. But they were commonly imported during the railway period.
Heidi describes her memory of bringing one of these teapots out of the site.
We brought one out and it looked like a bit of an alien when we brought it out. It had this mass over top of it. It turned out to be a melted glass display shelf. So the wonderful thing, the conservation thing, is that the melting temperature of the glass was lower than the glaze itself.
The railway pot was glazed in tin, which meant that, unlike some other ceramics, the glass did not fuse to the surface and instead might have actually protected the teapot. But it did pose an unusual recovery challenge.
Because of that difference in melting temperatures, we were able to get that glass sheet off very easily, and there was absolutely no impact to the glaze itself. We were looking at it thinking, well, how the heck are we going to get this glass sheet off? Because it was molded around it, but we could see it wasn't fused. And Tara, the lovely paper conservator, who's not an object person, came up with a hammer and said, I can get that off. And she tapped the glass sheet with the hammer in the perfect way, and it just shattered and broke right off. And then I was left standing there with a perfect teapot. Only a paper conservator would have done that.
Heidi and Casey are conservators trained in and committed to the protection, restoration, and responsible management of cultural material. But as they described the process of removing objects from the Lytton burn site, they dwelled less on the challenge of returning objects to their original states and more on the connection between the recovery of objects and the recovery of the community. They reflected, for example, on how, as objects came out of the ruins of her museum, Lorna herself seemed to grow.
When we first got there, she was devastated more than anybody. And you could see that in her posture and the look on her face and just the way she was speaking. She was very withdrawn from the whole operation. There were several eureka moments where there's something here. And we'd get very excited and we'd call Lorna over to look down. And as we started to bring things up, you could see her posture sort of straighten up and her speaking and decision-making start to strengthen. And with each item that we brought out of the basement, she was more of a participant and then she was a leader. You know, our initial aim was capacity building and trying to spread the expertise and bring it to local communities so that they had what they needed in the event of a disaster. And I think more and more, it's become something a little softer than that. And it's more about connecting with communities and helping them to heal after a disaster, because so much of that healing process is reconnecting with even shreds of their material culture that was salvaged. And dealing with that emotional tragedy and upheaval and helping that, just in a very small way, that rebuilding process so that they can get back to some kind of normalcy.
Even the broken objects conservators uncovered at the site held promise for remaking the Lytton community.
And there was this little shard of a porcelain teacup with a white with a blue painted flower on it. And it was a tiny cup and it was broken. There was only a section of the cup. And I thought, well, I'm sure Lorna isn't going to want this, but I'm going to send it up anyway because the flower is so beautiful. I didn't think about it again until I heard that Lorna, as part of the sorting process, when she found it, was delighted because it was an extremely rare pattern. And I'm not sure if it was this one or another one, but it had already lived through another cataclysmic event of some kind. And this was the second time she was seeing it. And it brought her much joy.
It's just a matter of getting to that step.
Lorna plans to rebuild the museum and hopes to break ground this spring of 2024.
I've been just stalling, waiting till they say, okay, you can actually put in a building permit, because there was a huge change with the bylaws between the old council and the new council about what would be required.
It's been a painstaking and at times exasperating project. As with the decontamination process, there have been ongoing delays in all aspects of rebuilding, from permitting to bylaws to new environmental building requirements. In the meantime, Lorna has been gathering new objects for the new museum.
Some of the other museums were very helpful to me, saying that they had more pieces that they needed, would I like them? So I've been given some of those already. Some of them are waiting until I have space. Several individuals have sent me items. There's a few more coming, like a family who's sending me their mom's wedding dress and a whole pile of her things. She's 95 and having to leave her home. So they're just waiting for me to say I have a good space to keep them.
The new museum will be an amalgamation of objects that survived the fire, reproductions of digital images of lost artifacts and documents, and a significant number of new and often donated objects. While the rebuilt collection will be materially different from the destroyed museum, Lorna hopes to steward the same stories.
And so now I just have the photos without scans, and so they're not the best, but they'll still tell the story, right? I can still put them in that regard. So there's about 500 pieces I have now. And so they will not be from the Lytton area, but as you know, in every mining camp and every railway camp, the same items were used. And so if they're looking the very same as items I had, I'm accepting them. And I'm sure I'll be able to tell the story by just perhaps buying a few significant pieces from a couple of collectors I know.
I was able to get these little game buttons, so they would have played gambling games with these, and they're made of glass, and they would have a set of black ones and white ones.
One small section of the new museum will exhibit damaged items that help tell the story of the Lytton fire itself.
We are able to pick out about 200 items. I would say about 40 of those would be good to display. Other than I'll do one small cabinet that'll talk about the fire. I don't want the fire to be the focus of this museum either.
As much as the fire has permanently altered the museum and its collection, Lorna emphasizes that she doesn't want disaster to overshadow the purpose of the museum itself, telling the story of Chinese settlers and migrant workers in the area. Lorna stresses the imperative of telling that story as vital to how she approaches recovery. Unlike some of the other cultural stewards we'll hear from in the coming episodes, for Lorna, objects can be replaced provided they can convey and carry forward the same story. Through this lens, objects spark stories in offhand encounters or in a joke between siblings. Stories gather around objects in the fabric of communities, in family lore, or in entwining people together in their common experiences. For Lorna, it is these kinds of stories that provide the foundation for a community's recovery from a devastating event like the 2021 fire.
How has the experience of the fire changed how you think about cultural collections?
I think it just pointed out the importance of them in any community because of what we've lost. So in any community, that is your history. That's our history, right? I'm saying, even if local people didn't spend a lot of time in the museum, they did spend some time, and that was their family's history, because so many families here were long-standing. I think it's really important because, yeah, we have a past, you know, we're not just starting today.
The Lytton Chinese History Museum lost most of its collection during the 2021 wildfire. The institution's recovery has faced many setbacks. The museum's rebuilding is more than the recovery of an undertold history, one gathered from among objects in trash heaps, objects littered in the landscape, or guarded in family collections of those dispersed from the Lytton area. The remaking of this museum also participates in a long history of surviving contamination in this landscape. The traditions of that survivance have taken many forms. For Lorna and the Chinese History Museum, stories are the basis for the survival of a community with a complex history and complex relationships. Telling stories and histories forms the basis for making community in an altered landscape, even as the threat of more fires lingers. In the coming episodes, we'll dive into more of the archival ecologies of the Lytton area and its cultural collections. Stay tuned for this ongoing exploration of how cultural histories, memories, and practices are changing with the weather. Archival Ecologies is created and hosted by me, Jamie Collins, and is a production of Blue Lab at Princeton University. For their support and expertise, we also thank, at Princeton, the High Meadows Environmental Institute, the Humanities Council, and the Office of the Dean of Research, as well as Kuvenda Media. This project has also received invaluable research support from Jamie Rodriguez, Kavya Kamath, and Molly Taylor. Voiceovers by Mario Soriano and Kavya Kamath. Music by Hamilton Poe.